Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop Treatment Update for Adults Living with Acute Lymphoblastic Leukemia, or ALL. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as many other blood cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and because of all of your interest in this program, we have on the call today over 427 participants on the call today. So you really come from all of the United States, mostly all different parts of this country. And we also have international participants from Canada, Cyprus, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So we really have a bit of a global call here with people from really all parts of the world. Today's program is supported by Pfizer and an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I'm going to first introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Farhad Ravandi, and Dr. Ravandi is Janice and Stephen A. Lasher Professor of Medicine, Chief Section of Developmental Therapeutics, Department of Leukemia, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Ravandi is going to present an overview of acute lymphocytic lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, in adults, current standard of care, and new treatment approaches and targeted therapy. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Ravandi.
Thank you very much, and welcome to everybody who is listening. And as you heard, I'm going to give an overview of ALL in adults, as well as some of the standard approaches and some of the new treatment approaches that are being developed. ALL actually as a whole has been one of the success stories in cancer therapy, especially in the pediatric population. It's been the forefront of developing treatments in cancer from the early days, where in children it was recognized that we need to use multi-agent combinations to treat kids, and it's also shown the success of therapy because in children, over 90% of patients with ALL are now cured and even probably higher. It also has been more recently exciting arena because new agents have been developed that Dr. D'Angelo and Dr. Park will go into detail that are promising to actually further improve outcomes in both children and particularly in adults. The other important advance has been understanding more of the biology of how leukemia develops in patients with ALL, what are the mechanisms that make these lymphoblasts to become leukemic and then proliferate and start causing problems. And this has been a significant advance in some subsets of ALL, particularly one that is called Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL, because the outcome of patients with this specific disease has significantly improved by introduction of new oral agents in combination, or sometimes even without combining with chemotherapy. So as I mentioned, initially, based on pediatric studies, even in the adults, the basis of therapy has been a combination of several agents that are known to be very active against lymphoblasts, and there have been several programs that have been developed all around the world using these multi-agent combination regimens. And these are actually extremely successful in producing responses in typically over 90% of adult patients with ALL. The only problem has been that about half of these patients will relapse. So unfortunately, although the complete remission rate after initial therapy has been very high, there has been a certain degree of relapse that is actually been hindering curing all patients. And this has also been problematic because in the past when the patient relapsed, we used to also go ahead and use combination chemotherapy agents, and these drugs do have certain degree of toxicity, and particularly in the older population, these salvage regimens were not highly successful. So relapse ALL used to be and still continues to be to some extent a major problem. But as I mentioned, things are definitely improving significantly. So understanding the biology is important, particularly in the subset of Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL. This is a specific subtype of ALL where the leukemic cells have this specific chromosome or gene abnormality, which essentially drives the process of leukemia development. And in roughly around 2000, a drug called imatinib was developed for a sister condition called chronic myelogenous leukemia, as well as in ALL, Philadelphia positive patients, which showed significant single agent activity, which has been very significant because it's an oral daily dosing agent. And addition of this drug to the combination chemotherapy regimens by multiple groups around the world was shown to be highly beneficial in improving survival and relapse-free survival in this Philadelphia positive. And over the last 17 years, there have been second and third generation drugs which act very similar to imatinib, but usually in a more potent way. And these drugs have also been used in combination chemotherapy regimens and are improving the outcome of this specific subset extremely by not just allowing them to proceed to an allogeneic stem cell transplant, which has been a standard of care in this specific subset, but also by producing long-lasting responses, at least in the proportion of patients. This is also very important in older patients. I don't want to give any age cutoff as a definition of older, but as we get older, all of us are going to be less able to tolerate the intensive chemotherapy regimens for ALL. And so in this specific Philadelphia chromosome subset, this addition of these oral agents, which are collectively known as TKIs, has allowed the intensification of chemotherapy, which means reducing the doses of chemotherapy and in some instances completely removing chemotherapy and producing high responses. So there is a lot of excitement in this specific subset of ALL. Now, as I mentioned, relapse in all subsets of AML has been and continues to be a problem because particularly in the past, the only thing we could resort to was combination chemotherapy, which apart from toxicity had limited activity. But Dr. D'Angelo and Dr. Park will talk about essentially a new era in ALL therapy that has been development over the last couple of years, and that's using essentially immunotherapy-based strategy. And by that, I mean antibody-based therapies, as well as what I think Dr. Park will focus mainly on, the CAR T cells, which are cells designed to attack the ALL leukemic cells by some genetic modifications. In terms of antibody therapy, there are now two new very active agents that are in development. One of them has already been approved, and the other one may be approved in the near future. And the exciting thing about these agents are they are relatively less toxic, but are, at least in randomized trials, are at least equivalent and actually better than combination chemotherapy that we used to use for relapsed ALL. So there is a lot of excitement about these drugs. One is called blinatumomab, and the other one that hasn't been approved yet called inotuzumab. And there is a lot of excitement about also incorporating them earlier in the course of therapy to reduce the number of relapses. This is what we have been doing in all cancers and particularly in all leukemias. When you have an agent that is highly active in the relapse setting, obviously it makes sense to bring it forward into the frontline setting as a combination with other standard agents that we normally use in the frontline setting to try to improve the outcome in the initial therapy and to reduce the risk of relapse. So this is essentially actually been an era of what I could probably even call to some degree a renaissance of ALL, because there is a lot of exciting strategies that are in development and are likely to be improving the outcomes even further that is already possible with combination chemotherapy regimens. And also of particular interest in, again, the older adults, combination chemotherapy regimens that we have used do have toxicity, and some of these new agents have a lower degree of toxicity and more limited toxicity and are much more tolerable in older patients. So it is possible to reduce the amount of chemotherapy using these drugs and try to actually not only achieve the same responses but also improve the outcomes. These studies are mainly available in centers that treat ALL in the form of clinical trials, so this is highly recommended for patients to consider to participate in these trials that are ongoing in these ALL specialized centers. I think that's a broad overview of where ALL has been and is at the moment, and I think I'm not sure if my time is up, but Caroline, please let me know.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Fondi. That was really, really outstanding, and also just wonderful description of many of the advances that are now available and progress that's been made in the treatment of ALL. So thank you for that, really starting off this whole program like that. Excellent. And our next speaker is Dr. Daniel D'Angelo. Dr. D'Angelo is Director of Clinical and Translational Research, Adult Leukemia Institute Physician, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. D'Angelo is going to be addressing Dr. D'Angelo is going to be addressing therapy for relapsed refractory ALL, the important role of clinical trials, and how research contributes to treatment options. And again, the focus here on this program is on the focus is on adults with ALL. So now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. D'Angelo.
Thank you, Carolyn. So I'll, as she mentioned, I'll be focusing on the novel approaches for treating patients who unfortunately have developed recurrent or relapsed leukemia. And as Dr. Ravandi has mentioned, there's been an excitement over the last 2 years with a multitude of new approaches and new agents that have either been approved or will be approved for the treatment of relapsed and refractory acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So I'm just going to review some of these that are now available. Blinatumomab is an antibody-based approach. It was approved 2 years ago for the treatment of patients with B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Just to remind those of you, there's different flavors of acute lymphoblastic leukemia. There's the B-cell and T-cell. Blinatumomab is only effective in patients with B-cell disease. And then it's only effective in those patients with B-cell that express a certain molecule on the surface. Most do. It's called CD19. But blinatumomab brings together the cancer cells to the patient's own immune system and activates their own immune system to hopefully eradicate the residual or recurrent disease. Blinatumomab is a relatively well-tolerated therapy that's infused over a four-week period, and multiple cycles can be administered. When blinatumomab was compared to standard chemotherapy, the regular types of chemotherapy that we typically use for patients with recurrent leukemia, blinatumomab, this antibody approach, was superior, both in terms of the toxicity, but most important, in terms of getting more patients into remission and having those remissions last longer, which leads to improved outcomes, specifically survival. So this is a very exciting development. In the United States, blinatumomab was approved a couple years ago, and it just recently, in June, received full approval because of this randomized trial that was successful. And, of course, once a drug is approved for relapse refractory, as Dr. Ravandi had mentioned, there are now clinical trials, and I'll come back to this at the end, testing blinatumomab in newly diagnosed patients. The second drug, which is also an antibody, is called inotuzumab. It works differently than blinatumomab. Inotuzumab attacks a molecule on the surface, again, of B-cell patients with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, only B-cell, who express this molecule called CD22. It's expressed on most patients with B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. What inotuzumab does is it brings a chemotherapy to the cancer cell. So it's almost like a magic bullet. The cancer cell is coated with the antibody inotuzumab, and then a chemotherapy is injected into it, hopefully eradicating the cancer cells. And many studies have shown that this drug works. It's effective and safe. It can also be given as an outpatient, which is rather nice. In a randomized phase 3 trial, similar to what I just described with blinatumomab, compared inotuzumab to standard chemotherapies, the same chemotherapies that we typically use for patients with recurrent disease. And it was shown that inotuzumab had a very safe profile and was better at inducing a complete remission and a more durable remission. So again, a very positive result. The European Medical Association, the FDA equivalent in Europe, has already approved inotuzumab, and we expect that inotuzumab is going to be approved in the United States within the next 1 to 2 months. So again, this is now a second novel approach, an antibody approach to the treatment of relapse refractory B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So very exciting in terms of developing new drugs for these diseases. And both of these agents are now being moved up front for the treatment of newly diagnosed patients on clinical trial to see whether we can improve the outcomes. Dr. Park will probably go into more details, but the other exciting immune approach is the development of CAR T cells for relapse refractory acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Again, B cell specific, and there are many different types of CAR T-cell products that are out there, but one, at least in the United States, got voted for approval, and this is the CTL-019 from Novartis, predominantly in pediatrics. So we'll see, and hopefully the FDA will give full approval by in a few months for patients, at least young patients and pediatric patients, for relapsed B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia using these CAR T-cell approach. What about other therapies for recurrent disease? Well, as Dr. Ravandi had mentioned, there are patients, a subset of patients, who have these mutations within the DNA of their cancer, not within themselves, but within the cancer. One type of this is called Philadelphia chromosome acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And as Dr. Ravandi reviewed, the initial drugs are often imatinib or Gleevec, dasatinib or Sprycel, but there are other drugs that are being used for these patients with Philadelphia chromosome disease, such as ponatinib or Iclusig, which is a drug that was approved several years ago for recurrent or relapsed Philadelphia-positive acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And then there's this whole new field or new description of the biology of patients who have a disease that's very similar to the Philadelphia chromosome, but you cannot identify it. This is called Philadelphia-like acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Patients behave like they have the Philadelphia, but you can't identify it. And we're just now learning how to characterize these patients, and we're just now learning which specific molecules may be effective for the treatment of these patients, both in the relapsed refractory setting and hopefully in upfront patients as well. So this is a whole new era, a whole new biology, as Dr. Ravandi had mentioned, but these are the major approaches to the treatment of relapsed refractory, both immune-based with blinatumomab approved, inotuzumab being approved soon, CAR T cells by the end of the year, and then these molecules for patients who have molecular or mutations within their cancer cell. What about for patients with T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia? Patients with T-cell disease represents about 15% of all acute lymphoblastic leukemia. They're more common in men and more common in young men, 15 to 30. There are drugs available for recurrent disease. One drug is called nalirabine. It was approved almost a decade ago. It can be used either by itself or in combination with other chemotherapies in order to achieve remission. And many patients with T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia have mutations in a gene called Notch, and there are medications or clinical trials trying to be developed to inhibit this molecule. Moving on to the discussion about the importance of clinical trials, none of these drugs would have been approved or will be approved without participation in clinical trials. It's extremely important for the advancement of the treatment for patients with B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. The common theme here is once drugs are approved in the relapsed refractory setting, there are clinical trials now exploring the use of these novel agents in earlier lines of disease, specifically in patients with newly diagnosed disease. The hope is, of course, to provide not only more effective therapy, but less toxic therapy for those patients. So as Dr. Ravandi had mentioned, I think this is an explosion or a luxury of riches of having a multitude of new agents that are available for our patients in the relapsed refractory setting and will be available for newly diagnosed patients in the upfront setting, but at least initially only on clinical trial participation. And with that, Caroline, I think I will close and leave it to Dr. Park.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. D'Angelo. Also very outstanding and a lot of wonderful options, again, for patients that weren't there before. So thank you for all that new information for people to absorb and to bring to their healthcare team. Excellent. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jay Park. Dr. Park is hematologist-oncologist with the Leukemia Department, assistant attending physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Park is going to address practical tips to manage complications and side effects, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Park.
All righty. Thank you, Caroline. So as Dr. Ravandi and Dr. D'Angelo kind of went over very important advances in treatment of an ALL and a multitude of treatment options, then I'll have a pleasure to talk about and what are the side effects that you can get from these these therapies, both the conventional and the traditional regimens we've been using before, and then perhaps, and also with the new therapies that that recently got approved and hopefully will soon be approved as well. So as many of you guys probably went through and are familiar with ALL regimen, still the standard, kind of the first-line therapy involves several years of a different combination of a chemotherapy, which, hopefully will change in the future, but that's kind of what we are dealing with at this time. And this multitude of chemotherapy, regardless of the age, is not the easiest one to deal with. And because of the several combinations, sometimes you can experience different side effects all at the same time in a different sequence. So it is really difficult to sometimes look like difficult to get a break from this. So you know, what are the practical tips and what are the side effects that you may get is that, you guys are probably well aware that, you know, one of the major things that we do worry about is the risk of infections, because some of the agents that we use, especially the traditional or conventional chemotherapy, will suppress your immune system in a way to kill leukemia cells, and by doing so, it will increase risk of infections. Sometimes an infection comes from within the patients themselves, or sometimes you're at increased risk of getting the infection from someone else. So any signs of the fevers, unwell, and fatigue, you know, that potentially could be the beginning of an infectious symptom, so it is important that you discuss the symptoms with your healthcare provider, which I'll discuss in a little bit more details kind of later on. The other side effects that people get because of the steroid is really one of the mainstay of the treatment for these patients, that there are, you know, people do get side effects of the treatments from the steroids, such as weight gain, and some people may lose weight as some of the chemotherapy side effects, mood changes, anxiety, you know, some people, and also in especially some young adolescents and kind of the younger adults in 20s and 30s, there may be also an increased risk of some bone health issues, such as avascular necrosis, which is kind of the infarction, meaning the dead bone, that can happen from the higher dose and a prolonged use of a steroid, so weakness of the joint, so that some of these patients may need to have an early joint replacement. So some of the bony pains that, you know, that people get, you know, it's important to keep on monitor those and inform your healthcare providers whether this could be the early signs of either the osteoporosis or the, you know, weakness of the bone or the joint issues. The other issues that the other side effects that people may get with conventional combination chemotherapy is the risk of blood clots that may happen or bleeding. That can happen as well. So people in the disc can present with a variety of symptoms, such as leg swellings or arm swellings or the pain. In the rare cases that people may also, the disc clots can travel to the lung and cause shortness of breath as well, or the chest pain. So these are some of the symptoms to keep an eye on, which can happen kind of at any point during the active part of the treatment. And then lastly, the other part that we'll talk about is the neuropathy, which is, you know, the numbness or tingling that, you know, the patients may experience as they get usually results from the vincristine, which is another mainstay that patients will get multiple doses of these medications and has side effects of kind of affecting the nerve endings and cause sometimes could be painful and sometimes could affecting the balance, the kind of the motility or dexterity of the hands as well. So I think these are all important points to keep in mind, and it is important to keep the inform your healthcare provider, because some of this could be preventable, but if not intervened early, it could be kind of lasting long or even permanent. So I think so all these side effects, when in doubt, is always wise to discuss freely with your doctors and the nurses who is very involved in the in your care, so that we can manage the symptoms better and hopefully intervene early as well. So these are some of the immediate side effects, meaning while you're getting the treatment. But some of the patients, even though the cancer is cured, which is great, but some may unfortunately get the side effects and the delayed side effects of these chemotherapies as well. So that's one of the reasons that you need to really stay close to your oncologist, or if the center have a survivorship care, it is important to follow up with those specialties to make sure to monitor for any kind of hormonal side effect that you may get kind of later on, or any cardiac side effect that you may get, the heart defect that you may get kind of as a delay side effect. So I think these are all important points to keep in mind. With the newer agents, as Dr. D'Angelo and Dr. Ravandi talked about, there are also unique side effects that you get with some of the new antibody-based regimens or the CAR T cells, which in a way is the mechanism that by works against the cancer cell is by awakening the immune system or activating the immune system. As they do, these immune cells, or the main, mostly these T cells, are working against the cancer cells and trying to, as they are killing off the cancer cells, they set off a danger signal within the body. So it's very similar to how our immune system is fighting the infection, that in similar side effects patients may get as these T cells are now, or these new drugs and new therapies are working against the cancer cells. So people make, as a result of immune activation, that patients may experience high degree of fevers, low blood pressure, or sometimes breathing difficulties that may happen. And one of the other unique side effects of this type of immune activating therapy is what we call neurological side effects, means that affecting your mental status. So that could be very mild, as very subtle changes in your memory, or fogginess or confusion. Some patients may experience actually some word-finding difficulties, so they will kind of sound funny, and they may not remember the conversation that you just had, kind of have a recalling issues. And in rare cases, these patients can get sick and have seizures or very kind of what we call in medical field obtunded, meaning the loss of conscious, you know, the kind of the deep sleep-like or almost coma-like state, which in most cases are reversible and transient, but when in, you know, in the midst of it could look very scary both to the patients and mostly to caregivers who go through this therapy together. So I think there are unique side effects as in with the newer therapy, so we appreciate these new side effects more as a part of the clinical trials and as they are approved. And there are multiple mechanisms that all the clinicians and the teams kind of involved in mitigating or managing these side effects too. You know, because of all these different ranges of side effects from the many different therapies and because ALL therapy tends to be very long, it is a kind of long process. So I think because of these reasons, it's very important to have a good support team. The support could come from, obviously, your family members or your friends, but it can also come in, and, you know, the patients should also take advantage of the medical team they have at the center they're receiving their care. We as a clinicians recognize that, you know, it's going to be, even as a physician alone, it's difficult to manage not only the therapeutic aspect of it, but also the side effects and the quality of life issues this patient's experience. So, you know, a lot of us have installed a good outpatient practice team with nurses who are familiar with the side effects, and in some cases, nurse practitioners and other specialty members from the social work and psychiatry to kind of help you get through because of the length of therapy is long, and no matter what the age is, you know, the therapies are often could be difficult to get through because most people are working while getting and taking significant time off from work. And when they go back to work, when they are maintenance part of the therapy, which is the oral part of the chemotherapy, they may still not feel very normal. So I think it is important for all of us to kind of get our patients get through that. So we recognize that, so I think we encourage our patients to reach out to us as well. But I think for those reasons, it's good to get a good support team as you go through this therapy. And it's easy for our patients, and understandably so, get discouraged when these side effects happen, especially younger patients when they're feeling so well before. It is hard to deal with, you know, even the fatigue and other symptoms they may experience too. So, you know, that we tell our patients not to be discouraged. It is normal to feel fatigue and all these side effects as well. It is that part of our job. We are here for that to help you get through. So, you know, for all these reasons, I think the last point is that it is extremely important, especially for ALL, oncological cancer therapy in general. It is a teamwork, but especially for ALL, because of the length of therapy, newer therapies with kind of unique side effects, it is important to work with a group of team members in the medical team and your family and then friends to help you get through. So please do keep in close contact with your healthcare team, doctors and nurses, for those reasons too. I think that's what I'll say for the quality of life and then the side effect part of my talk.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Park. That was outstanding and really so important. This is a very important part of just day-to-day living and functioning and being able to maintain your treatments and understand that there are lots of things that can be done to support you during your treatment. So thank you for really highlighting this and stressing it so importantly. And really, before we take questions, I just want to really piggyback really on what Dr. Park said. Obviously, your healthcare team is the place that there is a team of people that are there to help you get through your treatment. And some people actually, in addition to the healthcare team, there may be resources in the community that they can access as well that are free, and that may help them as well. So it's okay in this instance sometimes to have others involved. And so some people do contact Cancer Care. And just to give you a quick thumbnail sketch of what Cancer Care does, and there are many organizations like Cancer Care out there, So I'm just going to highlight what we do, but you do in your materials have information about all the other organizations as well. And they all do different things that can be helpful to you. We do offer financial and practical assistance to people living with cancer. Clearly, there are lots of issues that people struggle with living with ALL, and so sometimes these are very important to have. And we do have a large staff of oncology social workers here who really can provide someone to talk to, like counseling service, either one-on-one, or else we do offer many telephone support groups and many online support groups. And for our international participants, the online groups work really well. They work well for people in the U.S. and even in close proximity to cancer care just because of people's just busy lifestyles, you know, appointments, all the things working, all the other responsibilities that you all have and living every day. But the groups are really important sometimes for some people because it really allows them to hear from others who are coping with similar issues that they may be, and it gives them a chance to think about other ways that they might, other suggestions and things. We also do lots of informative programs as well, like this education workshop, and we also have, of course, a number of publications that you can order from us. And we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-4673, or for all of you, you can just visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And also for our international participants as well, it's a wonderful way to pose a question, to get access to one of our social workers, to get some of the resources that you might find useful. So with all that being said, now we want to take as many of your questions as possible, and I'm going to ask Crystal to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible, and at the very end, I'll let you know what to do if we don't get to your questions, how you can get your questions answered, but let's see how many we can take right now. So Crystal, do you want to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star 1 to ask a question.
And so we have a question from one of our online participants, and I'm going to give this question to Dr. Ravandi to start, and others may wish to add to it, but I'm going to start with this one. Dr. Ravandi, I had ALL as a child, and I am worried about it coming back now that I am an adult. What are the chances of ALL coming back as an adult? So if you could start with that one, Dr. Ravandi.
Sure. In general, as time goes, the risk of relapse gets less. Historically, with combination chemo, we have used a sort of about 3-year mark as a mark that we get less concerned about relapse, 3 years from the start of therapy. Unfortunately, less concern doesn't mean no concern. Unfortunately, late relapses do occur in ALL. However, I don't think this would be that common in childhood ALL. I'm not aware of the data on this, but I don't believe very late relapses are frequent. In fact, probably very uncommon. I can tell you from other leukemias in adults, for example, in AML, we have looked and patients who have been in remission for more than 5 years, the risk of relapse is infinitesimal, as in extremely low. But unfortunately, as I mentioned, I have had patients with acute leukemia relapsing 15 years after initial diagnosis. So in terms of your specific situation, I think the risk is extremely low, and you should essentially think of it as very unlikely to come back and live your life as best as you are doing and without constantly worrying about relapse.
Excellent. And Dr. D'Angelo or Dr. Park, do you wish to add to that anyway?
No, I think Dr. Ravandi covered it. I mean, it's something that is very, very rare, and we recommend continued follow-up either with the oncologist and the survivor's clinic to look for other complications, not necessarily relapse, or with their primary physician. But I would try to make it as out of mind, out of sight as possible, as Dr. Ravandi had suggested.
And Dr. Park, did you?
Nothing really much to add to what Dr. Lobrovandi and Dr. D'Angelo have said.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question. This question is for Dr. D'Angelo from one of our online participants. Should I consider a clinical trial for ALL versus other types of leukemia? Should I more consider, I guess, a clinical trial for ALL versus other?
Well, I mean, it depends on the trial and the situation. I mean, those of us who are on the phone right now, Dr. Ravandi, myself, and Dr. Park, you know, our jobs are to try and develop newer approaches, not just necessarily more effective, that's what we would like, but also safer approaches for the treatment of patients with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, both at the time of diagnosis as well as during my discussion I mentioned at the time of relapse. God forbid that should occur. So the only way that new drugs get approved and the only way that we learn how best to treat patients with this disease is by patients being willing to participate in clinical trials. And then one has to weigh the logistics, what's involved with the trial and whether or not he or she is able to participate at their center or have to go to another center. There's lots of things that go into the participation. In general, I try, and I'm sure my colleagues will echo that, I try to offer a clinical trial to all of my patients. Many consider it. Some don't for a variety of reasons, and a lot of it just because of the logistics. They just can't move or it's just too cumbersome to participate. But I try to offer clinical trial participation to every patient that we see.
And anyone want to add to that, Dr. D'Angelo or Dr. Ravandi or Dr. Park?
I agree. I mean, I think as a whole, medicine is advancing, and you know that there are many things possible in medicine these days. And for me, I think it's good to try to take advantage of these advances, but as long as it's well-informed and feasible. Obviously, if one has to go and stay and live in another state for 6 months to participate in a program, it has to be feasible for the patient. And with the approval of a lot of these drugs, many of these strategies may be available, at least to some extent, in local centers. But again, as Dr. D'Angelo mentioned, our job is to try to get things better because obviously the ideal situation is that every patient with ALL is cured, somewhat similar to what's almost happening in the pediatric population. And by the way, for example, the pediatric groups have been able to achieve this essentially by treating virtually all of their patients on pediatric studies. For many years, the pediatricians have been excellent in cooperating and enrolling all of the kids with ALL in the U.S. On these clinical trials, and this is why they're so successful in curing virtually most or virtually all patients with childhood ALL.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Park, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, I completely agree with Dr. D'Angelo and Dr. Ravandi said as well that I think there are many different types of clinical trials, and I think for any cancer care in general or any other disease for that matter, that the only way that we can advance, and as Dr. D'Angelo also pointed out during his talk as well, that, you know, the reason that we're able to, you know, to get several new therapies to be approved and approved to be soon to be approved for patients with an ALL is through these clinical trials. And there are a lot of kind of learning that happens through the process, and then that benefits the others as well as the patient themselves who participate in clinical trials. It's not for everybody, and there are a lot of other logistical issues that may be involved. So I think it is very important to at least ask questions whether offer the therapy or standard therapy or the off trial, whether what other options that patient that you might have, and then have to have a somewhat difficult decision to decide of all the options that what may kind of work better for you. It's not for everybody, and for some reason, even if you wanted to participate, and may not be able to. But just because you're not able to participate in a clinical trial for not meeting the eligibility criteria for some reason, and that shouldn't discourage you too much. And kind of, and obviously, the reason that you are in the kind of expert group of people, or your doctors, who are knowledgeable about this type of therapy. And so they can, if not on a clinical trial, but they can decide on a therapy that works best for you. So although whenever possible, we do consider clinical trials, but I think it's, the key is to kind of keep a clear communication going, explore options, and then be frank about these options with your doctor.
One thing I do want to mention is with the specific CAR T-cell trials, I think it is important to, these things are not widely available, but it is important, and I'm sure Dr. Park and Dr. DeAngelo agree, it's important, even once these become available, to participate these in centers that are very trained and have done a lot of these, at least initially, because there are complexities and toxicities and nuances that are very important to manage early and effectively.
I agree. I couldn't agree more about that. To just add just kind of the one sentence to that, I think ALL in general in adults are a relatively rare disease. I think one may argue that these patients may need to be treated at centers who are familiar and experienced in treating adult patients with ALL. Because the field is ever so changing rapidly, so I think you are in the right place for that. And especially for this new therapies with a very unique side effect, and I do agree that at least until kind of it becomes more widespread and widely available therapy, that to receive a therapy at a center or at a place that they're familiar with not only administering but managing the side effects of a therapy.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question is for Dr. Park. It's somewhat of a difference to the previous questions, but how can someone get a second opinion for ALL? Should I ask my current doctor for a referral, or should I try to find one on my own? So, Dr. Park, if you could suggest, because what you kind of a follow-up of what you're saying, it is not a very common form of leukemia, so the issue is how does one go about getting a second opinion?
So I think, it's the they mentioned that I think there are a variety of different ways of getting it. Probably the easiest one should be through your doctor as well. And I think there are some anxiety about asking your own doctor about getting a second opinion from another physician. But, it happens to all of us, both to Dr. DeAngelo and Dr. Ravandi. I sometimes refer my patients to them. And because even amongst us that, we can always learn from each other. So I think we never really take an offense from that, or the patient themselves shouldn't worry about offending your physician by asking for second opinion. So I think that's the good place to start, because he or she may know kind of the best place or familiar with kind of the physicians who they like to refer or have a kind of particular good relationship with an ALL management. So the other option, as they suggest, is kind of looking for your own too, which may not be the easiest. Sometimes if you don't know the area very well, that it may not be the easiest thing. I think for those, I think these type of the patient resources, either the Cancer Care Network or the Leukemia Lymphoma Society or other of these organizations, could be very helpful to connecting our patients to different doctors, either clinical trials, because they are very familiar with those. These type of organizations may be a good resource for them to reach out for them to get a second opinion.
Excellent. And yeah. Dr. DeAngelo,
sure. Yeah, no, I think, second opinions are important. You need to have confidence as a patient in terms of the decision. And just to remind you, you may be getting a second opinion even if you don't know it. We, at least in my institution, specifically with many of the junior staff, will review all the new cases. And obviously every difficult case gets reviewed as well in either interdepartmental meetings or just amongst ourselves. We have an hour set aside every week where we discuss all the new cases and any of the difficult cases in a group. And so you may be already getting a second opinion, even if you don't know it, just because of the way that we all practice. And because Dr. Park is right, we all learn from each other. And, you know, we may have certain ideas, but it's nice to hear and bounce off ideas from others. Sometimes the logistics of just going to another city or going to another center may be difficult, but I agree that, you know, having your physician coordinate that referral is always easier for a variety of reasons. And the most important is just to make sure that whoever you're seeing in the second opinion has all the most latest updated medical records and knows what he or your local physician, he or she, is thinking. That's going to be the most useful to yourself in terms of getting an opinion. And none of us are slighted by that. I mean, you know, if you're going to build a house, you're going to get, you know, before you do anything, you're going to get multiple references in terms of different builders or construction companies, you know, so why shouldn't that be the same for your health? So, you know, don't worry about offending anybody, but you know, ask questions, and you may be already benefiting from a group discussion at your treating facility.
Excellent. And a question now for Dr. Park, again. Since I started treatment, I've been feeling extremely tired, but it doesn't get better with rest. What can I do? So, Dr. Park, if you could address it. It's a common issue, fatigue, feeling tired, and if you could just talk about this from treatment from ALL.
Sure. So this, it could be a simple question, but it could be a very complicated thing as well. But, you know, fatigue is probably one of the most common side effects that any of our patients experience, not only for ALL, but any type of therapy that that people get. So I think it is important to bring this issue with your doctor too, because sometimes fatigue could be related to the medications or the chemotherapy drugs that you're getting, or it could be the symptoms of other as well. It could be, you know, chronic infections or acute infection, or in rare cases, it could be the symptoms of disease returning as well. So the point is that there are a variety of reasons why one may feel fatigue, and it could be just a lack of sleep and, you know, because side effects of the steroid perhaps. And so I think there are so many different reasons that, you know, the patient themselves may feel tired. So I think it is important to bring these issues and examine kind of what may be. And if these are due to some of the medications, there are sometimes there's a room for adjustment of the medications, but a lot of times it is important to stay on schedule to do so if it's a manageable side effect to get through. So once you figure out kind of what is causing the fatigue, not always easy to figure that out, but if you can identify those problems, then that could be the one. If not, then there are a multitude of other factors that may help to kind of one get through even without adjusting the medications, whether it could be social effects, because it could be the mood changes, or it could be depression too. So I think there are so many reasons that one may feel fatigued. So I guess the one thing that I would encourage is that, you know, to bring it out to your physician, the nurses, or, you know, psychiatrist, or whoever that you have a normal kind of involved in your care, to first examine what maybe the underlying issue is, and then to discuss with their and then kind of to figure out what we can do to kind of to help you cope with these issues and continue on therapy.
And there's one more question for you, Dr. Park, as well. Other than hand washing, what can I do to prevent infection?
You know, this is hard too. I mean, the hand washing is, I mean, there are important hygienes that one can take, especially during kind of the flu season, so respiratory virus season, kind of avoiding sick contacts and the hand hygiene as well. But, you know, a lot of times, most of the times, the infection will come from kind of the patients themselves, especially when they're in the midst of immuno or what we call myelosuppressive or blood count lowering chemotherapy. So when your immune system is low because of this chemotherapy, that you lose your defense mechanism. So we all live with the bacteria within ourselves too, but typically our immune system is strong enough to kind of the fight that or hold that. But when you lose that force, that's when this infection become a problem. So a lot of times, despite your best effort, you may still get an infection. That doesn't mean that you don't have to try. So we do encourage our patients to continue with kind of the good hand hygiene and others to do that. But it also, you know, at the same time, you have to draw a line, because you can't just live in a bubble and just stay home all the time too, because it is a long therapy. So it comes to balance. And so I think whenever you're out, you can do as best as you can to do that. But I think we also try to ease our patients that you don't have to worry too much about getting from others, because sometimes it may come from your own, and that usually, unfortunately, is not a preventable thing. So so there are kind of the different things you can do, but not, yep, that's it.
Thank you. And Dr. D'Angelo, did you want to add anything to those last two questions?
No, I mean, you covered it very well. I mean, you have to live your life, and there are certain periods in the therapy that your immune system is going to be more compromised than others. It's important to know that. And some physicians are more restrictive than others. There are certain periods of time where, you know, just hand washing is enough, and other periods of time where you may be a little bit more restrictive if your blood counts are low. And there's certain areas of the country that have certain outbreaks. It's important to know that. For example, where I live and work, we have the dirt can be problematic. So usually when patients' blood counts are low, I ask them to avoid gardening or little things like that to try and minimize risk of fungal infections. And obviously, you know, because the infections usually come from the cells, there's not a lot that one can do, but it's always important to avoid sick contact. So if somebody's known to be sick, it's probably not the time to visit. The goal of therapy, as Dr. Park has mentioned a couple times now, it's a long therapy, and the goal is to try and keep patients on time throughout their therapy. So whatever we can do to try and maximize that is important.
Excellent. And another question for you, Dr. D'Angelo, which could be our last late-breaking question, is how are all the different subtypes of ALL classified? I know we've addressed it partially,
sure.
But if you could just tell me that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we're learning how to subclassify them. Human nature is we're lumpers and sorters, so we try to put things into little boxes. And acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the big box that we put into that I always try to explain to my patients is we try to determine, is it a B-cell disease or is it a T-cell disease? That's going to change some of the therapies that we may use. It's going to change some of the approaches that we use. And for example, some of the recipes for T-cell will increase the number of these spinal taps, those lumbar punctures that one uses, or there may be different approaches, different clinical trials that a person can go on if they have a B-cell disease or T-cell. And then if you look at patients with B-cell disease, we divide them into those patients who have a Philadelphia chromosome versus those who do not. The incidence of Philadelphia chromosome increases with age, so very rare in kids, for example, much more common in older adults. There's a new biologic entity that both Dr. Ravandi and I mentioned very briefly called the Philadelphia-like, which is about 15 to 20% of the younger adult population. It may be more in older adults. We just simply don't know. Again, different strategies are going to be involved. And then the other ways that we classify it is based on the chromosomes of the cancer cells themselves, puts patients into different groups based on different prognoses. And this is true also in kids. So, what's true in the kids is also true in adults, and we try to subclassify B-cell, T-cell, Philadelphia-like, and then all the cytogenic abnormalities. So you can dice the pie up into all these small little components. However, having said that, most patients are going to get at least a backbone of very similar therapy, at least up front. The therapies, God forbid the disease comes back, may be very different.
Really wonderful presentation. And Dr. Park, do you want to add to that?
Really not much what Dr. D'Angelo mentioned before, but I think as we kind of come with the different targeted therapies that even though they may not be part of the classification, that some of the therapy has you may be a good candidate for if you express certain markers, if you have certain mutations, the targeting 19, 20, or 20 CD19, these are markers that expressed on type of B cells, as Dr. D'Angelo kind of nicely laid out. So I think your therapy may depend on those. I think as we learn more, and then these classifications it's an evolving field and it's changing as well.
And there is actually, this will be the last late-breaking question. We're not yet in the fall yet, but we're approaching fall season and various flu seasons and things like that. So someone was asking about whether, are they able to get immunizations? Is that an okay thing to do or not? So Dr. D'Angelo, do you want to take that one to begin with?
Sure. Yeah, it's, we try to vaccinate all of our patients to influenza every year. And age appropriate, we try to make sure they have a pneumococcal vaccine as well. The chickenpox vaccine currently that's approved is a live vaccine, so we at least in our institution do not offer that for patients undergoing therapy. Instead, we provide medications to try and prevent patients from getting it, or if they've had it, from having it reactivated, which is called shingles. So the dead viruses that are very safe, the flu vaccine every year, and the pneumococcal vaccine, if age appropriate, those are the things that we commonly do for all of our patients.
Excellent. Dr. Park, do?
Yes, I mean, I agree with Dr. D'Angelo too. So we do immunize just the same way that he has laid out. But, you know, in some patients, even despite this immunization, because if they're on active therapy, they may not mount a good immune response against these vaccines. So I think it's important for our patients to continue with the good hand hygiene as they normally do, because immunizations may not be as effective for these people. So that's kind of important to keep that in mind as well.
Excellent. Well, this has been an outstanding program. I know we could go on really all afternoon with questions, but we did say it would be an hour program, and so I want to thank our really excellent, outstanding speakers and all of you who've asked such excellent questions as well on the call today. It's been really amazing. I did say that I would help you all to get answers to your questions, many of you have questions still. So obviously your healthcare team is a wonderful place to start with your questions. I often think that sometimes asking a question here gives you a chance to sort of practice the question, but you're getting a sense from our speakers on this program that they relish questions from all of you. So you do want to ask your healthcare team your questions. And if some of you want to go to other places to get information, certainly, as I mentioned, the Leukemia Lymphoma Society has a wonderful call center, and they would be able to offer you information as well. And, of course, the National Cancer Institute as well. We always give that number, 1-800-422-6237, or you can visit their website, www.cancer.gov, and they actually have a live chat feature. So for those of you internationally or even in the U.S., you can post your question, and one of their information specialists will really research the question and help to give you some guidelines, and then you can go back to your treating healthcare team with your question. So, for those of you who want more of the practical or counseling services, you can certainly contact Cancer Care directly for our services. And perhaps most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we wouldn't want any of you to feel that you're alone in coping with ALL or with cancer in general. We want you to know that you're now part of a very large community of lots of different support organizations. I think all of you will have a follow-up to this program. There'll be evaluations that we'll send out to you. And the evaluations are really to get your feedback, to help us plan future programs, to see what you think of the program. But also we'll provide you with all those resources that we've mentioned during the program today, or that actually in the materials that you've been sent before the program. And as we conclude, I do want to mention that we do have an interesting program coming up, so it's not until November, but it's on mind-body techniques to cope with the stresses of cancer. And so I'm hoping that some of you may be interested in that. You'll get information about that as well. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.